There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hello, and welcome to Your Book, the podcast for literary nosy Parkers. I'm Daisy Buchanan, your host and the author of The Sisterhood, a love letter to the women who shape me. If you're on the Kent coast, come and buy it from the Margate Bookshop, my lovely local. This week, our guest is the author, director and global traveller, Richard Ayoade. He's written his third book about film, and this time it's about one very specific film. Ayoade on Top is his detailed exploration of View from the Top, the 2003 dramedy, Ayoade's description, starring Gwyneth Paltrow as a blue-collar wannabe air hostess who wishes to move up in the world, figuratively and literally. We went to one of the most bookish basements in the world, the Faber office, where we're assured that Richard lives, and we talked about rom-com tropes, the work of Dostoevsky, Scorsese, Woodhouse and Adam Sandler. Something that I did want to ask you is, given that nature of your fabulous book and the film, what is your favourite plane entertainment? Do you read in transit?
Yes, I guess reading would be the main thing. Yeah, I can't watch films on planes because of the sound being bad, and I don't like it not being in the right ratio. So reading is the best thing for me.
Movies of the mind.
I suppose, yes. What do you do on planes? Do you watch films?
I do a bit of a mix. Okay. Also, I find that on planes, I don't know what it is, but my sense of quality control goes, and I can see things and think, that was great! And then I come away and sort of revisit it and find myself disappointed.
There is meant to be a sort of a romantic comedy phenomenon on planes that people suddenly find themselves weeping. I mean, it's the altitude. The tomato juice. It's hard to know.
Definitely not what I'm putting in the tomato juice. Okay. It's all the anti-carcinogens. What do you like to read? Do you buy books at the airport or do you plan it?
No, I'd have a variety of books at different levels of difficulty depending on how tired and unfocused I am, which generally is very unfocused and very tired. So it'll range from... Well, what would the easiest thing would be probably non-fiction, and then different gradations of non-fiction, then fiction that is, I guess, what P.G. Woodhouse would call a breakfast book. And then a slightly harder level of fiction, and then the book that I would like to read, but I know I'm definitely not going to read on the plane because I won't be able to concentrate.
But you were almost having a sort of a book wardrobe in your bag to, you feel comforted knowing the options there.
There always has to be more books than it is possible to read with me.
I heard you on a podcast with Adam Buxton a few years ago talking about not being the happiest or most enthusiastic flyer or traveller. Am I right to infer that?
Well, there are so many things about flying that are not so pleasant.
It's unnatural, isn't it? It's entirely unnatural.
Yes, it's not right.
Dale hates flying.
Right, well, Producer Dale is right too. It's safer to be next to a nuclear reactor than to be in a plane.
Oh my God, don't tell him this. We will never go on holiday again.
Well, there's trains. And also, Here, England's pretty good for holidays.
It's pretty good. The environment is a very important thing to take into consideration.
Scotland, Wales. And, I know I'm in glass houses with
at
this.
At the time of recording, it might become impossible to leave the country anyway.
It could be, it could be Mad Max times.
So can you remember the first book that you read on a plane where you were just fully immersed, you forgot where you were, you're happy and relaxed? Have any favourite plane books?
Well, I can strike out the last two. Well, the first book that I didn't fly until relatively late in life, so not really till my 20s did I. I didn't go on holiday until our honeymoon. Not, you know, for the listener, not you and our honeymoon.
It's a polyamorous situation.
That would not be right. My wife and our honeymoon. I remember reading Moby Dick when I went to Colorado for a comedy festival, and so I thought I want to read a archetypically American novel in America because I hadn't been to America before. So I read Moby Dick, and that was really great.
Did you come in with any expectations of Moby Dick beyond, you know, this is the classic book, or did any of it surprise you or infuriate you?
I'd heard there's a lot of whale stuff. And that had been said to me. I was surprised at how brilliant the whale stuff is. I mean, the whiteness of the whale, the chapter on the whiteness of the whale is just extraordinary. And very often I find with something that feels like it's going to be difficult or weighty, I approach it like a frightened foal at a large fence and just this is going to drain me, I can't do it, I lack the concentration and intellect to tackle this. And it always is so much easier than reading something that you feel will be easy to read. Or when I say you, I mean me. So quite often I read something because I think, oh, this won't be hard, or I'm tired, or I just can't cope with something voluminous. But I'm always wrong about it. So say reading The Brothers Karamazov, which I thought, I can't read The Brothers Karamazov, that's impossible, that's like doing trigonometry. It's great, it's just great. And you go, oh, they really, there's a reason this book has stayed around.
Now, I haven't read it, I think, because I'm frightened for the reasons you say. So what? How do you get over that psychological block of bloody hell, this book is enormous?
It's a strange thing, because maybe classical music has a similar thing, or anything that becomes canonised as something that's important and needs to be treated respectfully. But, OK, let's take an example of something that's small and say, John Steinbeck, say, like, The Red Pony, read recently, or The Pearl. This is a weighty right end on the other end of the scale of length, Grapes of Wrath and East of Eden, which are big, but it's the same storyteller, it's the same a mode of address in a certain way, although obviously each book is different. But that same ability to absolutely get you in Of Mice and Men is in the longer books. And they're not... A lot of the reason sometimes why the books, some of those books are long, is because they do sustain. Now, there are books where you go, I just am not so sure that I can ever start this, like War and Peace or Proust, you just feel this is just too big. But I imagine they're good. I haven't read War and Peace. I've heard it's good. I bet it will be good. But also you sort of feel that you need to... Stephen King says that you need to learn how to read in gulps, big gulps, as well as tiny sips. And I think with a big book, you go, sipping is not going to...
There's something about momentum, isn't it? That the point of this book is they really wanted you to be carried forward by it as much as anything. You know, like, I'll have my 10 pages. And how do you find, in this modern world, in this crazy modern world, how does the way we live sort of alter your attention span, do you think? Is it, you strike me as someone who's always good at concentrating and focusing, but is it ever more challenging at some times than others?
No, I'm pretty bad at concentrating, and I think for a while I just really stopped reading just because of how busy it felt things were, or I was often watching things or researching a project, and I felt how if I'm reading, it has to be to do with the research of something, or I need to justify it in a way. And then, I don't know, maybe 4 or 5 years ago, I specifically tried to start reading with there being no underpinning justification for why I'm reading this book, that it's I'm not reading this for this to lead somewhere else. And I've enjoyed that. And but it is hard to read, even in London, it being noisy.
Yes.
It's hard. And just...
I should say, sorry, by the way, we can sit down.
Oh, yes. We've been on a treadmill for the first half hour of this. And phones are deadly for reading, I'd say, because they're designed to make you stay in a little loop of serotonin hits. And they're bad news if you have a completist urge.
Because there's no, it's bottomless, isn't it?
It's endless.
Infinity itself. The journalist William Leith wrote a book, oddly, about the Atkins diet, but sort of as an emotional and sociological phenomenon in our, cultural eating habits. And he talks about, certain foods being an advertisement for themselves. And I suppose, cigarettes are sort of the ultimate product, or, cocaine. You can just, keep the more you have, the more you want. And I think that's what phones do, isn't it? They're sort of activating that. They can't hold your gaze because there's always, but look over here, look at this.
And they have so many different functions. So I often find myself looking something up on my phone, like, say, how do I get to Russell Square, and then before I know it, I'm looking up, here's an archive of unreleased Lou Reed demos. And I go, I don't even know how I got here.
I'm in Luton now.
It's just so, it's such a strange path.
As a director, sort of work with literature, what is the challenge of a story that is sort of reflective, but not scene for scene, frame for frame, identical? And how much kind of killing your darlings do you have to do in terms of parts of the books that you loved that don't necessarily make the film work?
I mean, I've made two films, and even that sounds overly personal because you're in a collective making a film, that have been adapted from books. So the first one was adapted from a book by Joe Dunthorne called Submarine, and the second was adapted from a Dostoevsky novella called The Double. And that last project was something that a writer, Avi Kareen, had the idea to adapt, and he wrote the first couple of drafts of the script before we started writing together. And, I wrote a draft, and then we came together and worked on it.
Did you know the story before, or did you sort of come to it?
No, I didn't. I think I read his draft before I read the book, and the book is very, it's in his first period of writing before he went to the work camps. He wrote Poor Folk, which was a big hit. The Double, not so much. And it's very idiosyncratic, or I guess some people would say it's quite Kafka-like before, even though it's well before Kafka and Gogol-like, in that the story is about someone who, a lowly office clerk who encounters their doppelganger, but no one notices. And that seems to be the brilliant genius of that particular story, that no one would care that someone looks exactly like you. And the film isn't set in the same setting, it's not set in Russia, it's not a period piece. There are quite a lot of changes. Often, I suppose, the book is, as well as outlining incident, you have the opportunity to go into characters' thoughts, as you say. In films, you can go into characters' thoughts, there's voiceover, but that often feels like comment rather than real-time thinking, I suppose. I don't know that film's very good at sort of discursive consideration of a moment. It's very good at seeing people make decisions, and it's very good at seeing people conflicted between two decisions. And in that sense, it can do things, I think, better than books. For example, in a film, you have the opportunity of really seeing someone fast and getting quite a lot of information about them from various senses at the same time, sort of with music, with facial expression, with costuming, with lighting, with sets, with camera movement. It's very stacked, whereas a book can't stack information that same way, but what it lacks for that, it can take time. Time works differently in books.
Something as simple, I guess, as what a character looks like is so ambiguous, isn't it, in your head? And I think that there are lots of writers who don't want you to, you know, they want you to sort of to finish that illustration yourself, whereas it's the first thing you know in casting.
Yeah. And that's why I think, say, lots of Dickens books don't seem to lose as much in translation in a certain way, because they are so descriptive. I think Joe Dunthorne was talking to me about this, saying that when literature becomes a great deal to do with voice, and it has become to do with voice a lot, that makes it hard.
Yeah.
But then I remember reading something that Stanley Kubrick said, which is that if you know what a character's thinking and you have that roadmap, then you can try and think of exterior signs that will illustrate that thinking. And so, like, it can be like having a backstory.
Gwyneth Paltrow watching the most famous air hostess in all the world and thinking some thoughts and then saying, I will!
Yes, I mean, that's a very good example. Well, there's a scene in View from the Top. Gwyneth Paltrow, who plays someone who's blue collar, so already we're in, I guess, a kind of sci-fi world. She decides that she wants to become an air stewardess because she is down on her luck in a bar, having just been dumped by Tommy Boulay, the high school quarterback, who seems to, presumably as a high school quarterback, he's meant to be 18, I guess, as a... They leave school at 18, but she's clearly in her 30s.
It's baffling. Also, for as a kind of... For the Sex and the City fans, which I know are listening, and I am one, and you think that being dumped by a post-it note is the worst thing ever. To do a massive spoiler, dumped by birthday card.
Yes, dumped by birthday card. Because they don't make breaking up cards, that's the line. But that doesn't follow. I mean, just because they don't make breaking up cards, that doesn't mean you have to put it in
a
birthday
card.
I mean, it's literally, it's a false equivalent.
I remember this moment. I will keep this in its envelope in a special box.
Yes. And I'm not sure that they don't make breaking up cards. Anyway, so... I haven't been into Paper Chase recently.
I don't know when it... Do you think it was maybe... Would it have been made in the late 90s if it was originally slated for a 2001 release? I've done my homework, Richard.
Yes, it was slated for a Christmas 2001 release. I don't think they would have spent an awful lot of time in post-production. I almost think if it was going to be released in the end of 2001, they may well have started making it in 2001, or maybe at the very end of 2000.
I mean, nothing like a deadline.
Sure, it does focus creativity. So she's down on her luck in this bar, and she sees on the TV an interview with Sally Weston, played by Candice Bergen, who is talking about her book, My Life in the Sky, how she ascended to the top of guru world. I don't quite understand why, having been an air stewardess. Now, what seems strange about this is it seems a very... Do you know any famous air stewardesses, out of interest?
I was racking my brains. The closest I came was, you know, the ones in Airplane. But, you know, pretend air stewardesses, they don't count in this,
but,
into real...
It's not to in any way denigrate the profession, but... It just seems a strange thing to say that this will be a route to millionaire status, because you can't become a millionaire specifically doing that.
Now, you could be kind of an air influencer, couldn't you? That didn't exist, I think, at the time of writing or filming. But
that is possible.
This is possible. We're possibly theoretically entering the era of the famous air stewardess, but if that's a career, it's an idea.
Yes. But in a way, in order to be an influencer, it seems much better to already be a millionaire. That seems to be one of the prerequisites of being an influencer, is having the time to bother to influence other people rather than needing to get a job in order to live, which is what everyone does, other than heiresses, which in a way, in some senses, maybe Gwyneth Paltrow is in the realm of that kind of debutante. But a self-attested kind of feminist message of the film is leaving the small town, becoming an air stewardess, living your own life. But the reason Sally Weston became rich is that she met a millionaire on a plane and married him, but, which is fine.
You know, I mean,
but it's not... I just don't see, narratively, how that's a book. And it doesn't seem like something that you can achieve through effort and something that is to do with a particular endeavour.
Chapter one, playful giggling. Chapter two, slipping a little bit of extra whiskey in the cup.
Yes, it's, well, in the film, the way she won his heart is by giving him a lot of salty peanuts. That's not even...
So,
I'm not even making that up.
And then made his heart pretty much useless with all the fat and salt that it had to work through the system.
And also at altitude. It's a dangerous combination. So, and the tension, of course, in the film is that Gwyneth Paltrow's character, Donna Jensen, is already romantically involved with Ted Stewart, played by Mark Ruffalo, who, although he is training to be a hotshot lawyer, isn't a millionaire. So how's it going to work? How's this plan of her becoming incredibly rich going to work through going into the service industry? I'm just saying there are flaws in this film.
I wish I had
answers. I think there's a sense in which they may be being disingenuous about the possibility of becoming truly exceptional. No,
is it about welfare or is it about escape? And is the message perhaps you can never escape yourself, no matter what altitudinous point you're at?
Well, I think it sells a kind of ridiculous lie of exception, of being exceptional, which, in a sense, at the heart of the romantic comedy for a long time, has been this tension between work and relationships. So the general story is, let's meet this person. They work really hard. They work too hard. They don't make time for family. Look, it's your son's piano recital. I can't make the piano recital. I've got to get these reports in. But Bobby's been practicing for weeks. I know he's been practicing for weeks. But my boss is on my back. If I don't get this report in by Monday, I'm going to get fired. And then generally, spouse says, well, if you're not there, it's over. Rain, montage, various things, sadness, staying up late, doing reports. At some point, the person doing all of the reports says, you know what, I've had enough of this. I'm going to leave this job and I'm going to walk out of the office in a high-profile way, preferably witnessed by lots of people who maybe will stand on desks
always
and applaud me. Yes.
Grade in the palette.
Then run to the piano recital. They make it just in time. It's a big run. Plane. There's no plane. I'll sell you my ticket. How much do you want for the ticket? £2,000 for the ticket. But that's so much for a ticket. Who cares? I've got to get there. Plane. The plane's delayed. Okay, well, get on the coach. But I spent all the money on the ticket. Doesn't matter. Get on the coach. I'm holding a chicken for some reason on the coach. The coach is going. The coach breaks down. I've got to get.
And okay. The driver of the coach will probably say, it's for love. No charge.
It's okay. I have a Harley Davidson motorbike parked by this tree. You can use it. I've never been on a Harley Davidson. Well, go now. He's about to start the piano playing on there. That breaks down. Run into the place. Makes it. On the way, though, he's had an amazing idea about how to do the report. So the idea is that you sacrifice your work for your family, but then your work goes even better. There's no sense that you can, in the romantic comedy dream, that you give up anything. You do well in the work, you get everything that comes from that, and then you realise, oh, it doesn't do everything. So then you go into the relationship, but guess what? You get even more work. And that, I feel, is really terrible as a message, because relationships and family do require an awful lot of sacrifice, and I think it does mean you may not work as much. And I think that's really borne out. ironically, by people in the film industry who generally find it very hard to sustain relationships. And so you feel that you're being told in a film how important relationships are by people who are spending 14 hours a day on a set.
Do you think that they're sort of, well, obviously, you know, that people want a love story, and then, but for, you know, me and my buddies, we don't want less, we want more work. We want to know there's always going to be work, so it's got to have the audience and industry payoff.
But I think it's buying into absolute craziness, because there's a sort of sense, this is what it does that I think's bad, and unlike most traditional stories or any story that is good or would stay with you, is that everything costs or everything has some form of pain to it or something that is real. And you know, Brothers Karamazov is really about collective guilt. It doesn't say, well, it's fine, you've admitted what you did, now you're gonna get the Yamamoto file. But the thing that I find that's very sort of ultimately depressing about the romantic comedy is that it makes it results-based rather than process-based. Mm. So, in a way, what you want to do is behaving in this way or trying to do this type of thing or being open to this mode of being is important. What happens is not in my control. I'm more for a kind of Book of Job approach to the romantic comedy, where you go, it seems like everything he did was pretty good. It didn't seem to stop him getting all these ulcers. I just sort of like to see that film where she becomes an air stewardess, her relationship doesn't work out, she's just stuck being an air stewardess, and she realises that it was a completely silly idea to view this as some kind of escape, that you can't really escape from what you are. But that isn't what the film is at all. It's a very strange kind of wish fulfillment. Everyone is exceptional, which obviously isn't
one
true.
One cancels the other.
Well, it isn't true in the film's own sense of itself, in that it doesn't think everyone is exceptional. It just views the two heroes as being exceptional and everyone else basically being a bit more rubbish than them.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
We'll be back to Richard soon, but now it's time for my steal of the week. A bit of literary luminescence that is worth so much that you'd be lucky to win it in a Euromillions triple rollover. This week, it's a book I've come embarrassingly late to, American Wife by Curtis Sittenfeld. One of the loveliest and luckiest aspects of making this podcast is that I get sent, on average, about 20 or 30 books a week. If I allow myself to get behind on my work, leave some bills unpaid, and spend no time at all with producer Dale, I might be able to read 3 books a week. When one is surrounded by hundreds and thousands of books that are coming out in 2020, it is very hard to make time for a book that was published in 2008, but I am so glad I did. It's Sittenfeld's fictionalised imagining of the life of Laura Bush as the character named Alice Blackwell, and it's considered compelling, compassionate, and really astonishingly vivid. The thing I love the most about Sittenfeld's novels is that she draws the real world so expertly and with such nuance. And this is the best one of her novels that I have read, and probably one of the best novels I have ever read. American Wife by Curtis Sittenfeld is published by Black Swan, and it's out now. Now, back to Richard. I wanted to ask whether you had, sort of to go away from A View from the Top for a second, I'll come back, I promise. Did you have a Donna moment? Did you ever see someone on TV...
Right.
Doing something that
the
made you think.
Having been dumped by the high school boys.
Putting the sad breakup birthday card. But any, you know, sort of comedian or performer where you thought, I didn't know that that was something that a person could do, and I'd quite like to do that.
Yes, I don't think so. Despite it being so emotionally resonant in the film, I remember hearing records and thinking, oh, I want to be in a band. But in terms of what I'm doing now, this was not the plan at all.
So what were the records that...
One of them was... Well, it's a record, I think, that everyone had to be banned from playing those chords in guitar shops is Nevermind. Also, The Jesus and Mary Chain and Dinosaur Jr. and just that era of things. The Pixies. But no, I never... Most of what I'm doing now feels like a clerical error.
Is that thrilling?
No, I mean, it doesn't feel like a career either. It just feels like... I don't know what it feels like. Mainly, I suppose, a great deal of what I've done, I suppose, has come out of writing. So maybe that's a through line. And then there is a thing... that feels relatively modern, which I guess you could term the appearance. And I'm not quite sure what that is. That very often, and I found this with people who I know who write or who maybe make music, is that partly the reason they do that is because they don't feel that they can speak very readily or easily. And so I remember Michael Haneke saying this, that writing... Or making things as an apology for not quite being there. So a lot of people are able to interact seemingly well or are able to be more present, and there are some people who seem like they aren't quite present, there's something not quite gelling with them, and those people seem to need to go away and think a bit about it and offer sometimes a slightly paltry thing as... Maybe if you look at this, that might be better than listening to me.
I wonder if there's an element as well of writing, and perhaps I'd sort of venture to say directing, but please shout at me if you don't feel that's true. You're always, you've got to look and see and observe, and mm-hmm. It's a bit much to ask you as a writer to sort of to be in a room contributing when you're always sort of looking for things to see.
Well, there is a sense of being outside of things, which isn't just good, and it can mean that you are absent, and that can be unpleasant to be around for people. But I suppose maybe it shows that things that often feel you wouldn't wish to have can be useful sounds too, along the lines of a kind of utility, but that something meaningful can come out of things that you might not ordinarily want. I always think of, say, Martin Scorsese, who would say, you would not wish for your child to have such bad asthma that they cannot leave the house, seemingly. But out of that came this obsession with drawing and films and staying in his head in a certain way. And, you know, I, for one, have really benefited from his terrible inability to go out of the room because he had asthma, because... the lens through which he's seen stuff, I've felt incredibly grateful for. Now, if I were his parents, I'd feel bad for my son. in that sense. So, and I'm not saying that I'm doing something that is of use to people or in that kind of way. That's like an extreme example of someone who's obviously looking at things in a very interesting way.
I would argue that in the work that you do is, you know, it's profound and moving and joyful. And the more I live in the world, the more I think joy is the one thing that's sort of in short supply. Anyone who's bringing anyone any amount of joy is, that's a...
Well, it's hard to say. Well, I tell you, you know, Sullivan's Travels is a great film about that.
Yes!
You know, that's such a brilliant illustration of someone doing what they should really... what they have a gift for rather than what they think is worthy and important. And recently, about a year or two ago, maybe 2 years, I really started reading P.G. Wodehouse, which I just not... I don't know, for whatever reason, I just hadn't read or wanted to, which is just pure joy and just so... such a, an amazing world to be in and to...
Do you favour Jeeves and Wooster or the Blandings books or...
It's a good... I have a weakness for Uckridge. I do like him. He's such a brilliantly... He's always out of money and always trying to touch people for a fiver. And there's something slightly... I think he is always trying to live with his aunt in Wimbledon and has always been kicked out. There's something very appealing about him. But it's hard to beat Jeeves and Wooster for just how brilliantly written they are. I mean, the Blandings books are great too. For someone who's as focused on joy as he is and as delightful as he is, there is a sort of shadow sadness in it, I feel, in that there's no parents. He has no parents. Mm. Where are they? They're never mentioned. He is slightly on his own. I mean, I love how terrified he is of being married. There's something just very funny about that. And it feels that he really influenced those films in the 20s and 30s of Sturgis and Lubitsch. When you see all those butlers show up, you feel they must have loved Wodehouse.
I suppose there's perhaps a tiny bit of sort of Jobish futility to Bertie Wooster as well.
A Peter Pan quality as well, that he doesn't grow up and just...
And it's so kind of, you know, cyclical and sort of no matter what he, you know, whether he... And he's very... Even though he infuriates people, but he is so fundamentally kind-hearted. And he is, in his own, always trying to do the right thing. And it's, you know, it's the opposite of a view from the top in lots of ways, because there are no rewards.
Well, there's a bit in one of the books, I can't remember which one it is, where he does an inventory of good things that have happened and bad things that have happened. And in the good column is, well, here I am, what? And that, to me, is... When I read it, I just found that one of the funniest things I've ever read. But that is just being there is his greatest achievement. And he's materially very well off, but I think that is partially what allows it to be so funny, the lack of consequence, how insignificant this cow creamer is in, you know, how insignificant it is that he has to give this speech at the girls' school, how insignificant these tasks are, but they are very important, and he can't prioritise between two demands. He cannot serve two masters, and he just wants to be left alone in a certain way. And I feel one of the other things that does it really well is My Dinner with Andre, because what makes it comic is the fact that they're in this fancy restaurant and this world is going on outside, and where there's poverty and struggle and crime. But in here, they're in this sort of bubble. And I think, in a sense, well, everyone's in their own bubble of consciousness and what they think is important or not. And I think what you say is so right, that he's never better off at the start. He doesn't win anything. Mm. And he doesn't learn anything at all. He's never learnt anything in his life. The only thing, he's got the scripture prize, which he had when he was young, which he clearly cheated on. And that, I think, is what is funny about stuff, characters whose aims either just never materialise or that they just have really low expectations. And I think it's the aspirational aspects of romantic comedies that makes them so deeply depressing and so patronising. You're being reassured but also exhorted to be that little bit shinier and better than you currently are. Whereas P.G. Wodehouse is not recommending this as a way of life, I don't feel. He's not saying, learn from Bertie.
Are there any books, Wodehouse or otherwise, that you would like to sort of to make into honest romantic comedies or funny or truthful romantic comedies?
Well, it's been a while since I feel there's been a really truthful romantic comedy. Here's the other thing. There's something I feel about, say, this film, which is patronising to being an air stewardess, because there's a sense of, you know, I got to fly Paris First Class International and it wasn't everything. Now, I don't think that you could make that same film if she was a brain surgeon. There's something about some of these professions, and very often it's like they're a toy designer or they plan and fun amusement parks. There's something about saying, oh, what you're doing, that's not worth giving everything to, or it's not really worth concentrating. There's a sort of lack of weight.
Is it Ailing? He's got a list of approved jobs for men and women in romantic comedies.
Right.
Men are more often than not architects. Yeah. Very popular job for a romantic man.
I think in Click, the Adam Sandler film in which he gets a magic remote control, he's an architect in that, and David Hasselhoff is his boss, and he does miss the swim meet because David Hasselhoff says, look, these nondescript Japanese businessmen for some reason really want this.
Kind of ironic report. That the Hoff makes him miss a swim meet.
Exactly, yes. It's nothing if not metatextual. So, yes, architect is a good one, but I would like to see a scene where someone is performing brain surgery on a child and then they get a call saying, look, you're missing the fun run. And they put down the scalpel and they go, you know what? I'm not going to finish this operation. I've got to be there for my son. And if this guy gets brain damage, so be it. There's always the sense of, well, you can leave this profession. It doesn't matter.
Someone's getting stitches in their sewing room. Lol into the skin.
They've half done it and they go, you know what? You finish the stitching. It's like there's a sense of, oh no, what you're doing isn't important. What we're doing is important. We're filmmakers. We're going to finish this film. I'd like to have seen them walk off that film before it was finished to be with their own children. But they didn't walk off the film because they had to finish the film to tell us that we should walk away from what we're doing to be with our families so that we can not make enough money to go to the cinema to see the film.
So the ultimate romantic comedy that really, for want of a better expression, put its money where its mouth is the unfinished one. It's the one that's 40 minutes long and then there's just mad B-roll.
Or the romantic comedy... It just feels so in the service industry. It's like, it's going to be some laughs. Don't worry. I know you're tired. This isn't going to tax you. And it actually ends up being more depleting in a certain way. You feel diminished. Whereas The Apartment, which deals with really big things and sad things, not a spoiler alert, but, you know, attempted suicide, really bleak infidelity. It's not really consummated. Mm. It feels very real and also stemmed from Billy Wilder saying that watching Brief Encounter and going, I wonder what the person whose flat this is feels, the person where they're meeting, like he has to get out of the flat, what's he doing? And it just feels much more real about delusion and the sacrifice and the difficulty of seeing what people are, rather than you're basically great. It's just slightly reorder the priorities at the end of the second act and then it'll be even better.
It's absolutely all circumstances. No one ever has to confront themselves.
Not really.
It's a sense of I'm special enough and ultimately the world will work for me if I will it to.
And it feels patronising. I spoke Elaine May, who I think, you know, is a brilliant writer of comedies. She was talking to Mike Nichols and one of the things she said that she felt was wrong was not allowing herself to admit that she was as rotten as anyone else. And that being a true feminist statement, that in a way, if you don't allow the full terribleness of a person, it's almost like you're not trusting them to be a full human. Mm. And that's incredibly patronising. And so I think now writing is being more honest about everyone's capacity to be terrible. I think that's far more interesting and also is going to be far more funny. I remember a thing Spike Lee said, which is that even if you are the top basketball player in the NBA, it still doesn't mean that you're maybe not being exploited. So I think you can be ostensibly wealthy, rich, admired, doing something that is very hard, that is a choice, and you can still be exploited.
Well, it brings us back to Sullivan's Travels, kind of, doesn't it? The thing, you know, that you're... What do you want to do? What are you good at? Are those things different? What are you doing to bring you joy and satisfaction? What brings other people satisfaction?
Yes, I think in a way it's always in a margin of where you're not quite in control, where interesting things happen. And I don't know that anything good has ever occurred from someone wanting to deliver a message in terms of something that's writing. You can always tell if someone is approaching something didactically. My sense is that people like an area, and through their joy and enthusiasm and energy in wanting to go into an area, despite themselves, reveal something else, or they might want to say something about this, but really it ends up being about this. Or
as you said, that place where it becomes unpredictable or something you can't control, that can often be where the most interesting and exciting ideas emerge.
And also the fact that things can be so completely misinterpreted. And I imagine with most people's favourite books, there are many different ways in which they're enjoying them, and many of the ways were ones that the author didn't intend or couldn't have directly said, well, this is going to do that.
You know, reading Moby Dick, but I'm a massive whale fan and I just love whales even more. Whales are great.
But that's such a great example of something being incredibly specific and universal at the same time, and that seems to be often the case. Like, why would I ostensibly, from my background, have any interest in the Edwardian upper class or really sort of the source in New York Upper West Side public school? What do they call private schools there? Prep schools. And why would I go this? Why would I identify so strongly with this character?
If you're not sick of talking about it, I would love to talk to you about Catcher in the Rye.
Sure, no, I love it.
Because I was thinking about, you know, that no one is allowed to make a film of it.
Yes.
And whether how far you could make a film of it without explicitly saying that's what you're doing. I thought we've got Holden Hallfield.
Well, The Graduate, I think, is not bad, even though, of course, it's based on the Charles Webb book. But it has similar themes, I think, of... You could substitute the word plastic in that film for the word phony in a certain way. That sense of, well, what do you do? What does the generation above want from you? What are they pushing you into? And are you really able to escape it? I also, and it's completely not like that film in a way, I often think of the film Persona as being of a similar theme, which is, it's the idea that you can, with retreats, you can't ever retreat. The world will just keep coming at you. It's like water, it'll just keep dripping in. So you can't get away from it. And so his desire to be the catcher in the rye, he can't. He has a sister. He can't stay in childhood. He can't, even though he's incredibly traumatised by the death of his brother, he's going to have to be his own thing. He can't just be a custodian of prelapsarian idyll. He can't.
And you almost don't get to decide when you stop being a child and start being an adult. And even, you know, the people who love you and want to protect you, they can't decide that for you either. It's
exactly
going to happen.
And the thing, you know, most people would say, well, is this true? A lot of the most meaningful things in people's lives have come through things you would never want to have happened.
Asthma that makes you housebound.
Yes, or death. death of people you know. You know, that people you know will die. That this is not the worst thing, or illness. I guess asthma is an illness, or loneliness, or all sorts of things.
We can come back to this, but just as an attempt for me, as the book inspector, to stay on topic, which I've not been very good at with this conversation. Can you think, are there any deaths in novels that have really, things that have sort of upset you profoundly or sort of bothered you the most?
The death in Rabbit Run is just, I mean, really upsetting and so surprising.
That's Updike. Yeah. Right? I've been up a long time since I've read the Rabbit books.
Gosh, there's a death in that that is just the death of a child, which is just completely heartbreaking and just awful.
I do want to ask whether there were any, like Catcher in the Rye, any books you read around that time or in your sort of, you know, early adolescence or pre-adolescence where you did have that moment of sort of, you know, shock and being really delighted by something and seized with something.
Yes. Well, Grapes of Wrath was one of those books that it was the first book where I remember not being able to sleep and just having to read it through the night.
Was that something that you sort of happened upon yourself? Was it a book that someone gave to you? Or
I think maybe we were doing Of Mice and Men at school, and then I just really liked it and just thought, I'll want to read more of this person. Maybe it's a particular thing of adolescence, that there's something about that American literature of that period that's so direct, and you just feel like you're being told something by someone, and it was so different to what I'd read before. It just felt so adult.
Sometimes a lot of the books that we're encouraged to read at school, you know, we have to read until we won't pass the exams, everything can feel a little bit sort of superfluous. And then to read these, where there's real economy, and you're like, oh, there are books where they only say what absolutely needs to be said. That's good. That's what these writers know what they're on about.
Yeah, well, but also my experience of all the books that were set at school were, I really liked them. We did King Lear. It's amazing. To this day, it's my favourite play, and I think about it so often, and just, it was just terrific. Wuthering Heights we had to do. I loved Wuthering Heights. We had to do Richard III. Richard III was great. We had to do The Bell Jar. I loved The Bell. Like, everything we did, we had to do. What else did we have? We had a Tyrus Murdoch book. Was it? It wasn't Under the Net. It'll come back to me. What were the other books? We did The Wasteland. That was great.
Great syllabus.
That was great. I'm trying to think. There was one other.
Tyrus Murdoch. I bow down to the teacher who
everything
thinks
was great. Well, I had such a good English teacher. He was just amazing.
Because sometimes I think that you react one of two ways, don't you, to that sort of the being forced to read something. Do you recommend many books to people?
It depends what their sales resistance is, because there can be something oppressive about being given a book, or you go, I can't even read the stuff I'm currently failing to read in my lifetime. But yes, what was the last book? The last book I sort of gave to lots of people was maybe Wally Shawn's book of essays, which I think are really good.
I don't think I know that book. What are the essays like?
Well, he's just so good. He does a really good thing about, maybe connected to this, which is a class that he terms the unobtrusives. That when you go into restaurants, it's almost like they're people who are meant to bring food and do things, but not announce their presence. And what a strange thing this is. And how uncomfortable it is, and this sort of secret world of service that is being done to make our lives easier, but is a transaction and in some ways is dehumanising. And he's just brilliant on that. He's really good on not letting himself off the hook for what he does and consumes in life. But it's not pompous. He's not saying, I'm living this humble life. He's going, I'm bourgeois. I eat in restaurants. I do these things. I am comfortable. But there's this war going on. And what am I doing about it? You know, he's just brilliant at that tumult without saying, this is what I'm doing to help, and maybe you ought to think about trying to be halfway as good as me.
I have an increasing appetite for that when it does feel as though the internet is just full of screaming, this is what I think, and it's right, and you're all wrong, and you're all idiots. And someone's like, no, I am very, very flawed, and I do things that I know to be wrong or imperfect or inconsistent, but that's being a human.
Yeah, definitely, and I feel, you know, when you read something, you want, certainly in fiction, you want the idea that all the characters are being argued for, that there's no ciphers and that there's no obvious villains.
Are there any books that you've reread and changed your mind about, and sort of you felt quite like, you know, these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, and then come back and thought, oh, actually?
Maybe Nostromo. My wife... I always find this strange because I can say Lydia, but then it sounds like I'm just talking about my wife Lydia. She loves Nostromo, and so I found it really difficult to read when I first read it. The first 150 pages, I just can't even follow this. And then I started again.
And I do think when it's books, you know, someone you really, really love, and you're exchanging, but there's extra pressure, isn't there? It's not just, you know, a casual pal, and you can say, "I'll get around to it."
So that was more just. It managed to stop being difficult for whatever reason. I think, well, an example of not changing my opinion, it wasn't I thought it was good and then I thought it was bad or vice versa, but when I reread The Catcher in the Rye recently, and I've read it a number of times over the years, as I get older, the more sympathy I have for the adults in it. And when I first read it, I just went, he is great, how he sees the world, that he's forensically dismantling the bogus self-importance and smugness of adults. And now more I feel for the adults trying to connect to him, not being able to, wanting him not to do this, and going, but they don't know how to get him to be enthusiastic because they're running a syllabus and they're running a school and they can't... How can they help it? And they might not know everything that's happened, and I feel more for them. So maybe books deepen as you read them, or maybe rather than you having a completely different view, possibly.
And I suppose, you know, characters are people, not people that exist in the world, but they do exist in our imaginations, and, you know, as our relationship with people changes and we, you know, like different things about people at different times.
Yes, your difference, you bring your difference to the book each time.
And that's one of the sad and necessary things I think about adulthood, is realising that a certain amount of phoniness is maybe the necessary gravy to kind of to wash things. If you commit to being like completely authentic and uncompromising the whole time, you'll probably be punched in the face before lunch.
Well, I mean, in that book he has a breakdown, and it is a kind of how do you deal with inevitably being flawed and everyone else being flawed? How do you navigate that? That's very difficult. And everything's particular. That as I get older, the more I feel a sense of suspicion over principles. When I was young, it seemed that it was great to be highly principled, a highly principled person. But often that's a very inflexible person, a dogmatic person, a person who's unable to be wrong, and that someone more interested in particularity and changing and saying, oh, this was wrong, or I didn't get that right, or what do you think, or that seems more interesting.
On a very frivolous note, I would like to ask you, did you ever end up having a meal at a Happy Eater?
Yes.
This is, if you've not yet read, listeners to your book, IORD on top. This is pertinent and you must read it and you'll enjoy it very much for this detail and many more.
Well, there was a moment, I lived near Ipswich, and there was an on the A12, there was a Happy Eater. It was on the road back to our house off the roundabout. And I just really wanted to eat there. I begged my parents, and they had a no eating out of the house policy.
And it sounds like it was quite near your house.
It was really near our house, but they just went, there's no reason to go to a restaurant. We have food in the house. Why would you go outside? It just makes no sense. It's more expensive than the food we have. Why would you do that?
It didn't make any sense because you'd stop on a long journey, but you wouldn't be on a long journey at that point because you would have just left your house.
But we didn't have milkshakes in our house, and I'd heard there were milkshakes there, and that was very important. And so I finally broke them down, and they said they'd take me there for my birthday. I probably don't need to say I'm an only child. I think that's come across. But my dad was not used to waiting for food. My dad arrived at the table when the food was there, and when he finished eating, he left the table.
The other advantage of eating at home, if you don't cook.
Why? And also, he knew what he was going to eat. He didn't have to go in and make some kind of decision as to what he was going to eat. So we went in, sat down. They took maybe 3 minutes to come over. Already he's furious. He's going, what is going on in this place? This is chaos. He says what he wants. We say what we want. 2 minutes later, the food has still not come. And so he's like, we've got to leave. We've got to leave this place. This is run by animals. And so we left. It's when I don't have the time for this. And so that was our experience of eating. But I did go back to Happy Eat, I think, when I was older on my own. It was worth the wait.
Can you remember what you had?
I imagine I've had a milkshake and a burger. I think they did a lot of burgers with pineapples on. I think there was the era familiar. Where a pineapple ring was impossibly sophisticated. Pineapple, gammon, baked potato, sour cream and chives. That was a continental meal.
I'm hungry now.
I mean, what's the problem?
It really struck a chord because I don't know why, but we went to on long car journeys, very spoiled because we got to go to the Little Chef. But yes. I always wanted to go to the Happy Eater because of the playground.
Yes.
And for some reason, I don't know if my parents sort of taken against it in sort of a very arbitrary way, or there was just nothing, no Happy Eaters on the way, or there was one near our house and it wasn't deemed far away enough
it's
to go
a little
to.
Bit
so
more about market than Little Chef.
I never went to a Happy Eater.
I remember having a birthday party at McDonald's when I was young, and part of the birthday party was that they showed you the kitchen.
And I think I've been.
Did you go on one of those? Well, I remember thinking, what do I care? Like, as in, what am I going to do? Well done, lads. You're doing a heck of a job here. I mean, at seven, I had no curiosity about
the
mass production, of burgers on that scale. I didn't get, how are you managing to make so many burgers? How are you doing it? Take me through, where's the cheese kept? How are you doing the lettuce? I was just going, I just want a little figure. I want a burger, and maybe I might get a Coke.
Did you even have a special outfit to wear to go in the kitchen, like a hat and a... lab coat.
I think maybe, yes. I think we were put in little smocks or something.
That would have had some.
But it seemed so strange. It was quite a corporate visit. You go, why? Who thought the kids all... It's not like going in the cockpit in an airplane to keep it on brand. There's something like, why would you... I don't think you'd want to go into the kitchen and restaurant now.
It was definitely a birthday party. You weren't given a clipboard and you've not signed off on a sort of regional...
Maybe I'm confusing safety. This with my time as a junior food inspector. I think, you're right.
Huge thanks to Richard. Follow him at Richard Iowardi on Twitter and do read Iowardi on Top. At a time when it's easy to become overwhelmed with anxiety about very big things, it is both soothing and engaging to read his thorough, funny examination about one very specific thing. And you might be surprised, as I was, to realise that the analysis of rom-com tropes can prompt a lot of questions about the way we live. I'm Daisy Buchanan, and I have been your book inspector. Thank you so much for joining me, Paperback Chasers. You can find me on Twitter, @NotRollerGirl, and on Instagram, @TheDaisyBee.
Say hello, suggest some guests, and watch out for shelfies. Visit our show page, acast.com/booked, for more information about our guests and a list of the books they've talked about. If you have any other queries about the podcast, you can email us at whybooked@gmail.com. Your Booked is produced by Dale Shaw for New Alaska and hosted by Acast. Please do subscribe, rate us, and leave a review. It's great to hear what you think, and it helps other people to find the podcast. For now, I leave you with some inspiring words to remind you that great literature can enter your life and change it when you least expect it. In his 2015 book, Life Lessons from the East End, Danny Dyer wrote, "Harold Pinter is the major British playwright of the 20th century. If you've ever been on a drama course, you've studied him. If you've any education in theatre at all, then you know who he is. He has his own style that's famous throughout the world. I had no fucking clue who he was when I met him."
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Hey folks, it's Mark Maron from WTF. I've been talking to all kinds of famous people in my garage since 2009, including a sitting president.
You know, I don't imagine you were flying in here on the chopper thinking like, you know, I am nervous about Mark.
No, I wasn't.
Okay, well, that's good.
That would be a problem.
It would be a problem.
If the president was feeling stressed about
coming to my garage.
Coming to your garage.
And now there's even more WTF when you subscribe to the full Marin to get weekly bonus content and all WTF episodes ad-free. Listen to WTF wherever you get podcasts and subscribe to the full Marin at go.acast.com/WTF.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.